Gravitational waves are distortions in space-time that radiate out from incredibly powerful objects and events, such as pairs of neutron stars or colliding black holes. They haven't been directly detected yet, but many researchers are trying to do so using a range of different techniques. Chiara Mingarelli, a PhD student at the University of Birmingham, is one such researcher.
We use pulsar timing arrays. And so a pulsar timing array is a bunch of pulsars which have very regular times of arrival at the Earth. And if they're delayed by a certain amount of time, then we can infer that a gravitational wave has passed between us and the pulsar. And so the sources of these waves in the frequency band that we're looking at, which is the nanohertz frequency band, the sources are supermassive black hole binaries and galaxy mergers. And so these signals, when they pass the pulsar, that wave is modified. And then the same gravitational wave can modify the signal at the Earth. And you can think about it in sort of a triangle configuration. And so what happens to the signal when it gets from the pulsar to the Earth is that there's about 3,000 years of evolution of the binary between those two points. And so we can actually see the difference in the signals at these two points and then infer what the binary is doing in those 3,300 years.
So in order to see gravitational waves clearly and in a defined way, you're looking for individual huge items like pairs of black holes or pairs of galaxies colliding. Could we not see the same effect from a very large amount of material that's very spread out that exists between us and the pulsar? Or would you see a different effect?
Different masses of black holes and neutron stars both produce gravitational waves, but the supermassive black holes produce the gravitational waves we expect to see in the frequency band that's accessible to pulsar timing arrays, so about 10 to the minus 9 hertz to 10 to the minus 7 hertz, whereas detectors that are on Earth, like LIGO or GEO in Germany or Virgo in Italy, they're sensitive to the tens of hertz to the kilohertz range, and so that's more neutron stars that are closer by and stuff like that. So for pulsar timing, there are some things that produce lots of noise, obviously, and in order to be sure that we have a gravitational wave, we actually need tens of nanoseconds in timing precision, and this is only available with a handful of pulsars right now. And that's why all of the pulsar timing arrays around the world are getting together to form the International Pulsar Timing Array so they can share their best timed pulsars and then make a detection of a random background of gravitational waves from unresolved sources. And we can't resolve the sources right now because we don't have enough signal with respect to the noise that you might be talking about. But the more pulsars we have, with the better times, the more likely it will be that we can start maybe resolving individual sources, like the supermassive black holes that I'm interested in. But right now, they all fall in the same frequency bin, so not one is big enough to be on its own and to be individually resolvable. They would have to be very high mass and have very high frequency, but by very high, I mean 10 to the minus 7 hertz. So it's all... take it with a grain of salt.
You've almost made it sound very easy, that, that we have these arrays of pulsars where we can measure the timing, and when we see the timing change in a defined way, we know that we have seen a gravitational wave. Now, seeing gravitational waves is big news, so I assume it can't really be that simple.
Well, no. So in order to get these, you know, these tens of nanoseconds in timing precision, there's a huge amount of reduction that goes on with the data that we get. And the reason that we use more pulsars is because the gravitational wave signal is correlated between pulsar pairs and the noise isn't. And so the more pulsars we have, the more the signal gets built up at the Earth, and so the higher signal-to-noise ratio you get. And this is why everyone's very interested in sharing our best pulsars, because then we can really boost the signal at the Earth. But there's a lot of noise in the data, obviously. So there's a lot of noise from the interstellar medium. So basically what we see from the pulsars are these radio waves, but they're not all at the exact same frequency. And so some arrive earlier and some arrive later, because of the interstellar medium. And so it's kind of like looking through a tunnel of electrons. and changes an effective kind of refractive index. So like when light goes through water, right, depending on the wavelength that you're looking at, it'll get bent in different ways. And so we have to mitigate those effects and so that we have just like one nice kind of peak. And so there's a lot of folding in on itself to get a nice kind of coherent, well-defined peak for the pulsar data. And then clock corrections, because these pulsars are so stable that, you know, our clocks might add errors onto them when we try to actually time them. So, yes, there's a lot of work that goes into even getting these times of arrivals, and then even more work used in getting these timing residuals, which is this, you know, 30 to 50 nanoseconds that I was talking about that we achieve now. So there's a lot of work and a lot of data is going to be needed to convince anyone that we're seeing gravitational waves. But rightly so, because if you're making a statement like that, then you really need to be sure. And so for the random background, we hope to produce a characteristic curve that can only be created by a gravitational wave propagating through our signals. And this is called the Hellings and Downs curve. And so this will really be the one kind of shape that we can only get in our data if it comes from a gravitational wave that goes through our pulsar timing array.
So it sounds like the physics is pretty well understood, the observations are taking place and will be improving. So really now it's down to an awful lot of very complicated maths and understanding the models. What do we need to do to refine them?
There's two different ways to analyze the data right now. So there's something called the Bayesian method, which compares different models. And so I say, here's my data. This is what my signal would look like if I had a gravitational wave. And so what's the likelihood of this signal if there's a gravitational wave? And then I do the same thing, saying that there's just noise. And then I see which one has a higher likelihood. Now, the problem with this is that you never have an absolute answer. You can just say that model A is more probable than model B, but it doesn't tell you exactly what it is. But actually, the best limits on the background have already been set by this kind of analysis. And the other one is something called a frequentist analysis, where they do correlations. And then that will give you a sort of absolute number as to how much you can trust your results. And so right now, there are these two competing fields. And it's hard to say what analysis will be used in the end, but I think the strongest detection will need to be analyzed by both methods to convince both parties that there is indeed a signal, and indeed the rest of the world, because if I analyze the data using Bayesian methods and I say that my model prefers noise, and you do it the other way using frequentist methods, and you say, well, there's actually quite a strong probability that there's a gravitational wave here, then what are you going to do? So you definitely need to have both camps agreeing.
And what will it mean to researchers and to astronomy in general when we find or when we confirm that we have seen gravitational waves? What differences will that make?
Well, that's really an amazing question, because before the advent of radio astronomy, there were so many things that we didn't even know what to ask, because we had no idea what was out there. And then when we could see radio waves and we could see so far in the distance and we could see all of these sources that had been redshifted to such long wavelengths. And so with gravitational waves, we think something similar might happen. So there's already been indirect detections of gravitational waves by monitoring neutron star binaries. And in fact, that won a Nobel Prize in 1993. But the direct detection would tell you things about the waveforms, which tells you things about the sources that create the gravitational waves. And so this would settle a lot of arguments, particularly in my field, between some people who argue about galaxy formations and how they formed, and are they through mergers, or did they just condense, and what happened in the early universe. And so this kind of information might help fix a lot of ongoing battles, even in cosmology, because the Big Bang left relic gravitational waves, which are all around us, which have a very long wavelength now. But who knows what's out there? The thing is that gravitational waves aren't attenuated by gas and dust, and it's not, you know, reflected and absorbed just how like light is, and that's why it's so difficult to see far away using electromagnetic radiation, which is a fancy word for light. And so gravitational waves are equivalently gravitational radiation. But because it's the stretching and squashing of space-time itself, it doesn't care what's lying on the space-time. It's actually the space-time itself, like ripples on the surface of a pond that are moving, and then we're like the little boats floating on the surface going up and down. So it's a really great way to see things that are very far away that we'd never be able to see. So it's more like listening to the universe instead of seeing it. They're more kind of, you can think of them as sound waves in that sense.
Chiara Mingarelli from the Gravitational Waves Group at the University of Birmingham.